This is Seeking Delphi, episode number 29, Sustainable Superabundance, featuring David Wood. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. A little over 2 years ago, I began this podcast with a two-part series that featured London Futurists chairman David Wood on his then new book, The Abolition of Aging. Now, Wood has released a new volume that fits as a perfect complement to The Abolition of Aging. It's Sustainable Superabundance, a Universal Transhumanist Invitation. Sustainable superabundance certainly sounds like something humanity will need if aging is indeed ended. Today, we welcome David back to the program to discuss his latest effort. David, welcome back to Seeking Delphi. It's always a pleasure to have you.
It's my pleasure to be back.
David, let's start with a couple of questions about the title of the book. Sustainable Superabundance, a Universal Transhumanist Invitation. So how do you define transhumanism, and what is it that makes this book an invitation?
So transhumanism is the view that we can and should use science and technology to significantly improve the human condition, that we can and should improve our physical bodies, our minds, our emotional selves, and our social selves. It takes the view that we're not yet at the end of the desirable course of evolution. Evolution has created us as a many splendid being with wonderful features, but also many terrible flaws. And transhumanism says we can take advantage of science and technology to take control of our own evolution and get to an even better place.
And what about invitation?
So it's an invitation for more people to get involved in this discussion and to get involved in projects. Initially, I had another subtitle there. It was the word manifesto instead of invitation. It was saying, you know, it's time to act. It's time to change the public conversation about the future. It's time to speak up and say that the future could be very much better than the present, but it's not going to happen automatically. It's going to require people highlighting the best ways to use science and technology. But I reflected on that, and I had some feedback from various early readers. And out of that discussion, the word manifesto got changed to invitation. In part, it reflects the fact that it's not a complete picture. There are many parts of this picture which I do feel confident about, but there are many other parts of this vision of the future which are still vague and need a whole lot more thought and collective discussion. So I'm encouraging people to get involved in that.
Now let's talk about the sustainable superabundance part of it, because my reaction the first time I saw that was to think back to your volume, The Abolition of Aging, where you advocated for, chronicled the history of and the present state of research into human rejuvenation, ending aging, perhaps creating an indefinite lifespan. And it seems to me that if we achieve that, then sustainable superabundance is something we're going to need. So was that in fact in mind when you wrote this, and is it intended to be a follow-up to that and an answer to some of the questions it poses about the future of humanity in a post-aging world?
The two books form part of the same conversation, the conversation about what it's possible to do with science and technology. So it is possible to reverse aging, I believe. It's possible to abolish aging, which means that we consciously decide that we're no longer going to put up with aging. But the same bits of science and technology that are involved with that, things like nanotechnology, stem cell therapies, synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, all of these technologies will have wider impacts on human possibilities. So it's not just that we can have an abundance of longevity. It's an abundance of health. It's also an abundance of intelligence, an abundance of food, an abundance of energy, an abundance of creativity. So all these things follow from the same considerations. Some people say, let's just focus on the greater longevity. That's a simpler proposition. Let's not complicate things by talking about the human nature or talking about transhumanism. But it's my view that when people will think things through, they will realize by themselves that there's something bigger going on here than simply having longer lives. Indeed, just having longer lives wouldn't be that attractive if the rest of the planet remains as it is today. We will have issues of sustainability. We will have issues of running out of food. We'll have issues of not having enough fresh water. We'll have issues of growing inequality. We'll have issues of the climate probably being more chaotic. So we can't just look at the greater longevity. We have to think about the bigger picture, and that's what comes out in this most recent book.
With all these scenarios for superabundance, one could get the impression that you're playing the techno-optimist. But in fact, you do point out that there are a lot of hazards, a lot of roadblocks on the way to getting to the preferred scenarios. So how do you see that possibly playing out?
So right on page 2 of the book, after having set out in the first 1.5 pages a glimpse of the future wonderful possibilities, I say, but first we face some hard, critical choices. If we choose poorly, technology will do much more harm than good. If we choose poorly, a bleak future awaits us. Wretched environmental decline, bitter social divisions, and a rapid descent into what I call the dismal new dark age. So you're quite right. There are scenarios ahead, which I consider to be all too likely. Scenarios ahead in which we don't reach that superabundance. It's more like a super tragedy, a great humanitarian tragedy. If I look ahead to the middle of the century, I don't think it's likely. I think it's very unlikely that we will just be more or less the same as today. This business as usual projections in which we might be 10% or 20% faster or healthier or fitter or more efficient. I think that the credible future scenarios divide into two types, which are the superabundance and the super tragedy. It's because the genies that we're letting out of the bottle with this technological development, the revolutions of the fourth industrial revolution, nanotechnology, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, and neurotechnology, they're not going to allow us to keep the world on a steady trajectory. They're either going to push it in a much worse situation or a much better situation. So that's the first thing I want to make people think about. This is actually a very important set of choices ahead of us. We need to weigh these things up with a great deal of thoughtfulness, great deal of humility in terms of the possibilities. And then we're going to have to take some resolute action to make sure that we end up with the desirable future rather than the undesirable future.
A really important question which links superabundance with the abolition of aging is that of future population projections. The UN says we're going to peak at 11 billion at the year 2100, even without substantial longevity increasing. So there are those that feel, wow, this is going to just blow us through the roof and make it even harder to achieve sustainability. On the other hand, a recent book by two Canadian authors, one of them a journalist, one a scientist, called Empty Planet, suggests that population's actually going to peak around 2050 and start to decline, and do so naturally, not because of any either natural disaster or man-made disaster. So I'm wondering, have you looked at those scenarios, and what's your feeling about the future of population?
Well, yes, indeed. So what usually drives the thought that we're going to have a decline in population is the observation that more and more families have just one child or zero children. We have smaller families than before, in part because we no longer need to have so many children as a kind of insurance policy, because many fewer children die in youth than used to be the case. So the social forces that led people to, by default, have large families have gone. And now with women being educated and women being a core part of the workforce, we tend to have smaller families. And people project that forwards and say, in that case, what's happening already in some countries, like Japan, like some of the Scandinavian countries, like, I think, Italy, where there are smaller numbers of children per family and where there is less immigration, we're seeing the decline in population sizes. So that's one set of possible drivers for the change in population of the future. But I'm not sure I believe that. I think that in the future, we won't just have technology that allows us to live longer. We'll also have technology that allows us, if we wish, to have children much more easily, more straightforwardly, by means of something called ectogenesis, which is that the baby can be conceived a little bit like IVF, perhaps, outside of the bodies, and it can grow outside of the bodies in artificial wombs, as was already mentioned by J.B.S. Haldane back in the 1920s. And such an idea was also included in the novel by one of J.B.S. Haldane's friends, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. Of course, it was very much a dystopia there, but there's no reason it should be a dystopia. So I'm not sure whether this is going to take off or not, but it is interesting that when this subject comes up, a significant proportion of women in the audience say, you know what, they might be interested in that. So maybe people who wanted to have larger families and didn't for whatever reason will once again open up to that idea. So I think we have to consider that there may be significantly more people in the world in 50 or 100 years' time than even the UN projections. And I think that could be all right. Even if we had double or triple the population we have today, I think we could, if we are smart, feed everybody with very healthy food by taking advantage of, guess what, science and technology, with things like vertical farming, with things like artificial photosynthesis, things like lab-grown meat, so we no longer need to have such large parts of the planet given over to growing food for cattle, which are then slaughtered. Instead, we can grow meat much more straightforwardly. So there's a variety of ways in which I argue that we could use the planetary resources to look after maybe even up to 100 billion people on the planet, and still give people plenty of healthy food and delicious food.
Rather ambitious, but let's take that with all that science and technology then, though, and the abundance that you're suggesting, the more that's automated, the more there is that concern that we hear about all the time about jobs. And of course, we're not seeing it right now. There's actually labor shortages in a lot of the developed world right now, but there's no guarantee that that's going to continue as we automate more things. So what about the economic issues? And it's not just the theory, but the practice and also the political obstacles to things like universal basic income.
Big, important questions, and we need to look at them. So my vision for the future is that people won't need to work, at least they won't need to work for money. We will all have things we will want to do, but we'll do them regardless of whether or not we're being paid for them. A bit like people pursue their hobbies, their holidays, their other pastimes, often with great vigor, often great enthusiasm. So that's what the future is, possibly full unemployment rather than full employment. And so I have a chapter in the book when I look at some of the arguments about why this may or may not happen. I do think that automation is going to take over more and more of the tasks that are currently done by humans in the workforce. I think also that we are seeing some of this already, not so much in unemployment, but in what people call technological underemployment, which means that people can still get jobs, but they are jobs that pay less than they used to. And this is partly the reason why the median salary hasn't gone up in real terms much for the last few decades, even though a small number of people are being paid much more than in the past. So the mean salary has gone up. But if you put everybody in order and look at the people in the middle, the average salary hasn't changed that much. So the question is, if people aren't working, how are they going to be looked after? You mentioned part of the solution of that, which is a universal basic income, which is some way to redistribute the fruits of the automation to everybody. And we can talk in a minute about the political issues that idea faces, but I only think it's part of the solution. The bigger part of the solution is the abundance in itself, which means that what people need in their lives should be available at lower and lower costs. A bit like more and more of the information in the world is already available at lower and lower cost, with access to, for example, Wikipedia, which has much more information, much more easily accessible than used to be with Encyclopedia Britannica, which was a very expensive proposition in not too long ago. So we are seeing an abundance of informational goods in many places, and we need to hurry up and have an abundance of material goods too. And I think this is certainly feasible. We should be using techniques such as 3D printing, techniques such as nanotechnology, which we could talk more about, to create more and more material goods at lower and lower costs. And that should be society's imperative. Society should not be thinking, how can the GDP, the gross domestic product, be raised? It should be thinking instead, how can we ensure that the basic necessities for a good life are available to everybody for as low a cost as possible?
So what about the economic and political issues here? They're not going to be easy to surmount, at least not in the short term. What are your feelings about that?
So the transition is going to be hard. There's no doubt about it. The transition away from the prevailing philosophy, which is that if you don't work, you're a scrounger. You don't deserve. So the view in history has been the Protestant work ethic. Lots of other cultures have got some similar idea, which is you have to make a great contribution to the economy in order to benefit from the economy. And in due course, we're going to have instead the abundance principle, which has been summed up by we all get what we need just by being part of the human society. And we already have that abundance mentality in some of what we do. We give freely to our children without demanding that our children go and clean chimneys or work in factories, as used to be the case a couple of hundred years ago. So we're prepared to share some of the abundance of society with children without requiring them to work. Also, people who have reached a certain age, the retirement age, society gives them at least some handout. And I want to see that extended. And it's already operational in some parts of the world in small scales. So in Alaska, there is this dividend which is paid for from the profits from the oil industry, amongst others, in Alaska. This has a bipartisan support. It's not a huge amount of money, but it shows what's possible. Other countries also have wealth funds which are used to help distribute to everybody in society. If it's thought of as a redistributive taxation, then people get alarmed. But if it's thought of as a dividend in which we all share by virtue of us all being part of the human society, then maybe it's more acceptable. Though I realize there's a lot of minds that need to be changed along the way. And this comes back to the point of philosophy. We have to change a lot of traditional thinking. Just like people used to think, you know, it's a bit of a shame that people die, but it's good that people die. And they came up with all kinds of justifications, poetic, cosmic, karmic, religious, poetic, whatever, as to why it was, in the words of the Latin poetry, dulci et decorum est pro patria mori. It's sweet and honorable to die for your country. And later on, we said, you know what? This is bullshit. You know, we don't need to have that philosophy. Death is bad. And we no longer need to accept that. So it's going to be the same with many of the other prevailing views in life, such as that if you don't work, you don't deserve anything. I think we will change to have a much more communitarian viewpoint, and we need to accelerate that.
is there potentially an existential crisis here? I mean, with transhumanism, you're going to change the very essence of what it means to be human. We're going to be post-human, more than human or just different than human. And you take that standard work ethic away that gives a lot of people meaning. And is there going to be a crisis of meaning for people in their lives?
Well, people will go through a mini crisis in many cases if they haven't really thought or explored other possibilities. But we can help each other. We can help each other to be true to our own inner spirit, our own inner promptings. And it could be exploring ideas, as you and I love doing. It could be exploring music, exploring mathematics, exploring the physical world, exploring nature, exploring the solar system, exploring relationships one with each other, exploring sport, exploring puzzles, exploring the great drama, exploring the historical drama, whether it's Shakespeare or Breaking Bad, or it's also exploring a whole new drama that artificial intelligence is going to create for us, including not just a drama on the written page, but drama on the screen, and drama even in which we can immerse ourselves as a 3D participants in virtual play. So I think people with help will suddenly grow and cast off the mindset of scarcity and will adopt instead the spirit of creativity, exploration, and abundance.
In your section on abundant technology, there is the coverage of artificial intelligence, as one would expect, seeing as it seems to be the number one hot button today in terms of technology and controversy thereof. So how pervasive is artificial intelligence going to be in achieving the superabundance? But also, what are your feelings about our ability to control it? Because there are those that think either inadvertently by its own evolution or rather purposely by rogue operators that it might do more harm than good.
So it's another extremely important topic. The short answer is that artificial intelligence is like many other technologies. It's double-edged. If we handle it right, it could be wonderful. If we don't handle it right, it can cause great trouble. It's a bit like fire or electricity. Or let's say chemistry. Chemistry had the ability to create new fertilizers, such as via the Haber-Bosch process that managed to create the great agricultural revolution. But the same people who were behind that were also behind the creation of new explosives and chemical weapons. So artificial intelligence is a bit like that, except it is more powerful by huge orders of magnitude. So the need to get it right is even more paramount. Can we control it? Well, it's going to be touch and go. Software is already out of control in many ways. We look at the likes of Facebook and social media, and we can say in some cases it's wonderful, in some cases it's terrible. It's terrible because it's making us more tribal. It's leading us into more emotional responses instead of thoughtful, considered responses. And it's also used by people to manipulate lots of others via micro-targeted advertising that take advantage of knowledge about what our hot and cold buttons are and gently nudging us in ways that often we don't realize into taking different positions than we previously might have had. So software is already out of control. The people who were behind the creation of Facebook are now, as they look back, if they're no longer part of Facebook, the company that is, they are more free to speak out and say they regret what they have done and they wish they had thought more carefully about what was involved. And they wonder, how could it have been different? My answer is they should have thought more about it beforehand. And it's exactly the same with artificial intelligence. AI is, and algorithms are controlling more and more parts of our life. They are involved in figuring out who gets credit ratings, good credit ratings, who should get the job interviews, who do we meet in new romantic encounters via websites. All kinds of things are governed now by algorithms, and if we're not careful, these algorithms will sometimes do good things for us, but oftentimes go wrong because guess what? Software has bugs, and complex software has complex bugs, and opaque software, which a lot of artificial intelligence is, has opaque bugs. So we have to change that. We have to bring the evolution of artificial intelligence much more into the public light, into the public eye, and we have to exert a wise democratic control over it rather than just leaving it at the whims of the technology companies and of the various political forces that want to use it for their own purposes.
As a final point here, I'd like to call up something that the late Stephen Hawking said in the last year or two of his life. He felt that the only way we could maintain reasonable ethical and legal standards for the deployment of many of these disruptive technologies like artificial intelligence was to establish a global government. Now, that seems rather unrealistic to me, seeing the way the world is today. Maybe someday, but certainly not right now. But do you see, is there some way on a global basis that we can prevent a kind of tragedy of the commons where individuals, rogue operators, organizations, or even countries deploy to their own benefit to the detriment to the rest of us?
Well, we have to work with some of the existing bodies, flawed as they are, to have some promotion of some of these discussions. And where the existing bodies aren't working, we have to informally create new ones. Not that I want a dominant world government. I don't want a big government just for the sake of a big government. I think there are some things that do need to be regulated, do need to be reviewed and discussed on a global scale. And if the existing bodies aren't doing it, then the new bodies must step up with that responsibility. And that's the call to action, which is at the end of Sustainable Superabundance. It is to people who are concerned with this to find existing groups and communities that are looking at this, whether it's the IEET, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology, or it might be the Humanity Plus organization. There's groups of people at various connected with various universities, such as a group in based around MIT called the Future of Life Organization, FLI, Future of Life Initiative, sorry. There's the Future of Humanity Institute based in Oxford in the UK. People should reach out, find which body of people they feel drawn to, and they should get involved in building greater public insight and greater public control over what's going to happen. Local control should remain over things which should take place locally, but where things are of critical global significance, they have to be reviewed by global citizenry.
David, just another great job on this book. I certainly look forward to more of your work in the future and to possibly having you back in the future. But for now, thanks for joining me today.
It's my pleasure to talk to you, Mark.
There is one global organization making a major effort to guide ethical standards for the deployment of artificial intelligence and other disruptive technologies. That would be IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. It's the world's largest technology organization with nearly 500,000 members. They've just released the first edition of a book of standards and guidelines for the ethical design of autonomous systems. John C. Havens, who is executive director of the IEEE initiative that authored this work, will join me in the near future to discuss it. In the meantime, I highly recommend David Wood's book, Sustainable Superabundance. Links to all relevant sites can be found on the webpage for this podcast at www.seekingdelphi.com. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Player FM, or YouTube, and to follow us on Facebook. My technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf, and until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.